Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Music, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Emily Allen, and I'm the host for this episode today. Our guest is Dr. Droge Droge, author of Chocolate Surrealism, Music, Movement, Memory, and History in the Circum-Caribbean, published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2016. In Chocolate Surrealism, Droge Droge highlights connections among the production, performance, and reception of popular music at critical historical junctures in the late 19th and 20th centuries. Droge illuminates musics of the Circum-Caribbean as culturally and conceptually integrated within the larger history of the region. Droge examines the deep interrelations between music, movement, memory, and history in the African diaspora. He finds the music both a theoretical anchor and a mode of expression and representation of Black identities and political cultures. Music and performance offer ways for the author to re-theorize intersections of race, nationalism, and musical practice and geopolitical connections. Further, music allows Droge a reassessment of the development of the modern world system in the context of local, popular responses to the global age. The book analyzes different styles, times, and politics to render a brief history of Black Atlantic sound. A little bit more about our guest. Dr. Droge Droge is Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. So welcome, Dr. Droge.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. So before we dive into the book, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
I like to work on music. I actually like to play music. If I would have gotten a recording contract, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But so instead of being a professional musician, I became a professional academic. But music is still my key sort of theoretical and intellectual sort of interest as a way of doing history. I guess I'm originally from Kansas City, Missouri. I don't know if that means anything to anyone, but there's a guy named Charlie Parker from there too. My family is, my father is from Kenya and my mother is from rural Louisiana. So I'm an actual African American. That also really very much informed my childhood and informed my kind of musical interests. My father had tons of 45s from all over Africa that I used to listen to as a kid. My mom had all kinds of LPs like jazz and R&B and soul. It essentially started off, just pilfering my parents' record collection, and that just sort of developed into a lifelong passion.
Very cool. And like as a musician, what do you do?
I frustratedly play some bass. I've been really getting into bongos and percussion recently, but now I'm primarily a bass player. Well, in quotes.
Very cool. That's awesome. What do you like to play, I guess, on bass?
Everything I kind of talk about in the book. Right? I mean, the book is really, really about my record collection, which is also about like my kind of just kind of musical taste. So like I'm a frustrated jazz musician, but so I end up playing like a lot of funk. I love to play
awesome.
African styles and rhythms and that kind of stuff. So, But yeah, no, pretty much from James Jamerson to Jaco Pastorius, those are like kind of my two twin poles of sort of thinking about bass.
Really cool. And I think that adds a whole other layer of like depth to the book, you know, that I think our readers will pick up on, you know, as they go through your text. And, you know, going a little bit more into your like background as well, this book is based on your dissertation, correct? And so what was this process of turning a dissertation into a book like?
I mean, it's actually kind of based on my senior thesis when I was an undergraduate. I wasn't supposed to talk about that in the text itself, but that's really kind of where it came from, because I went to UC Santa Cruz as an undergraduate, and I had like this really fantastic committee there, a guy named David Anthony, who was a tremendous historian. His recent book on Max Georgan just came out a year or two ago, but he's also a hell of a saxophone player, and he had a handwritten notation of John Coltrane's Giant Steps solo on his door. So I just like knocked on this guy's, I was wandering the halls and there, and I just knocked on this guy's door, and I was like, you know, who are you? And this giant, you know, like dude answers the door, and we sat down and started talking, and he kind of really helped me out by kind of figuring out other people that I could talk to about this. So like this guy named Herman Gray, who was a fantastic kind of sociologist, and also a wonderful poet, English teacher named Nathaniel Mackie, who's still writing like wonderful stuff. And then there was the chair of all this when I was an undergraduate, was this woman named Angela Davis, who probably should go without introduction, but she was one of the people who really encouraged me to, like, you know, like, we can really deal with the music and take the music really seriously, not just, you know, fun stuff to dance to, but to, you know, start digging into the history, start digging into the culture, and start, you know, like really listening to the sounds. So this all started off my way kind of back in the day, but then I was very much focused on African-American music in the United States. And then my ears kind of just started evolving, because I took a long time off between undergraduate and graduate school, and most of that time I spent working in record stores. And so I was literally like kind of living in record stores and was kind of collecting and pulling all this music together. And I realized like, oh, there's a much wider world, and this Caribbean is, you know, I'm going through the Caribbean, basically I'm trying to work my way back to Africa. So like the next project I want to do is, you know, so started in the American South, went further south, and now I'm going to try to go back across. So one of these days when I get this other project together.
Man, it sounds like you've been on like an ongoing journey in terms of all this mentorship and support you've had with, you know, this project that we're talking about today. And then you're continuing that journey geographically from a scholarly point as well, which is really cool. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about your future work as you continue going more towards the Africa direction, quite literally in this case too. And it's really interesting to hear, like, as you've, you know, developed as a scholar, how much this project has, it sounds like it's meant a lot to you back from those early days to present, you know?
I'm literally writing about my record collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's awesome. So going more to like a very obvious question to kind of pivot towards the book itself now, starting with the title, right? Can you explain to our listeners what the phrase, like the first part of the title, Chocolate Surrealism, means?
Oh, I borrowed that. I sampled it from a fantastic band in the Bay Area called the Brown Fellinis. And it was the title of an EP they put out, I want to say, in like 91 or 92. They're just a great band, and jazz, hip hop, funk, all kinds of different stuff, right? You know, and they had this one track that really got me kind of thinking. It's called Herodotus on the Nile, and so that just kind of inspired me as I was kind of writing and thinking, you know. And so the title would just kind of fit with what I was trying to do, because it is really about looking. It's about kind of pastiche. It's about combinations. I mean, this is why the book is kind of unreadable, because I was trying to, you know, kind of do it in this way. That was both not really avant-garde, but kind of trying to blend all these interests together in ways that didn't necessarily sort of or logically kind of fit. but the through line is the groove, right? You know, so, and that's where the title came from. It's these guys who I believe are still playing around in some incarnations in the Bay Area. So,
but that's really cool. And I think that, you know, centers this music, you know, in that way as well. It's definitely like a groove that you can pick up on, you know, over the course of the book. And, you know, it was like a really interesting journey, like going through the text in that way. And I definitely see what you're talking about in terms of there's just so much to look at in these scenes, which is really cool. And then going on to like kind of terms, key terms for this book, you know, you mentioned a couple of things throughout the book, polyrhythm and root work, for instance. So can you explain those ideas to our listeners and how you develop them throughout the book? And also, are there other key ideas that you think someone would need to understand going into this text?
I don't think there's other key. Let me just start with the first part of that. Polyrhythm, obviously, you know, like multiple rhythms at once, to me is a very useful way of conceptualizing the music in the African diaspora, right? You know, so we do have multiple rhythms. I mean, if you just want to even stick with the Caribbean, right? You know, you got some rhythms going on in Cuba. You got some rhythms going on in Trinidad. You got some rhythms going on in Puerto Rico, right? And they're all happening at once, right? You know, so just, you know, if you want, I'm just going to think about that. But also just the idea of musicians interacting together around multiple meters is also a very useful and I think kind of a rich metaphor for thinking about history and thinking about, you know, the individual in history and the individual in society and that kind of thing. You know, finding your groove, finding your rhythm is not just crucial for musical performance, it's actually pretty critical for, you know, just life in general, right? You know, so the music is the metaphor in that kind of sense, right? But that's where like the polyrhythmic kind of idea comes from. But then the root work, right, then would take us back to sort of African kind of herbal traditions, right? You know, and the idea of using roots and herbs in the natural world and the natural environment, not simply for survival, but also the importance of reworking in terms of religious customs and ceremonies, and further, right, the using of roots and herbs and stuff to, you know, poison one's masters, which was a big problem during the era of slavery, particularly in the Caribbean, right? So reworking has these multiple sorts of meanings, and it also kind of draws on the practice of music itself, right? You know, we're always kind of learning from the masters. We're always doing root work as musicians, like going back and listening and figuring out how to play different stuff is a historical kind of thing, right? You know, so that's the idea of root working. It's a very active thing, but also a historical kind of orientation, right? You know, like how does one learn how to play? Right? How does one learn how to perform? There's a wonderful phrase by one of my great mentors is Stephen Feld, and in his book Music Grooves, he has this wonderful phrase, you know, he's just like, you know, it feels good to know how to feel good, right? You know, and that's about that kind of participatory framework, right? You know, and that's about working those roots, right? You know, we all know like when that good part of the song comes around and, you know, that's when, you know, you just got to move to it, right? And so, but that's about root work, right? You know, that's about digging in and having that kind of grounding, right? So there's a necessarily historical component to the kind of performative aspects of music, and that's what I was really kind of trying to get at and trying to get with.
Cool. Thank you for breaking that down for them. I thought that was, again, really creative take on unifying so much subject matter of the text amongst, you know, other ideas, of course, too. But I thought those were interesting takes on that. And still sticking with kind of like introductory stuff, there was a sentence in the actual introduction that kind of struck me, quote, "The power of Black music lies in its feelingful representation of these transformations of African peoples into Black folks." So can you talk more about that statement?
I mean, in many ways, like this particular book and a lot of the stuff I read, I'm just writing kind of footnotes to Amiri Baraka's Blues People, which is one of the finest books on African American music in the United States to ever be written, right? You know, and just the way in which, you know, he kind of breaks it down with these ideas of like the changing same, right? You know, the way in which the music evolves and changes, you know, and he has a wonderful line that's so clear. You know, he says, you know, the music changes because the musicians change, right? You know, and then it's tautological, but it's so obvious, but it also bears repeating and bears meditating on, right? You know, so this is kind of what one of the real kind of animating things behind it is, but it's also thinking about, as I said before, right, you know, like Robert Plant Armstrong and like Stephen Feld, these notions of affectivity, right, you know, and how, what is it about this stuff that just, you know, like what would make something good? And it's about that feelingfulness, right? It's about that ability to represent the ineffable, like in some sort of way. It's like, what, how does music kind of just capture the mood, essentially, right? You know, and that's kind of what I want us to think about. But more importantly, right, how music is such a sort of central kind of cultural glue for these kinds of communities in struggle, right? You know, emerging from slavery and this, you know, sort of horrific history of the Atlantic slave trade and, you know, the continued ongoing oppression, discrimination, you know, racism, poverty, all these kinds of things, right? You know, and music, right, becomes not just a way for Black people to come together, but also to simply survive, right? It becomes a very important tool. What the wonderful poet Ntozake Shange called, you know, survival motions, right? This is how we move because we have to, but we also groove at the same time, right? You know, yeah. If you can dance to your oppression, you know, Black people have mastered that. That's kind of what I'm trying to talk about. Just in terms of thinking about the diaspora and thinking about these different kinds of musical sorts of traditions, right? You know? And so people like Sam Floyd, right, The Power of Black Music, as I said, Stephen Feld, right, his music grooves, it's kind of all about, right, this, the effectiveness and effectiveness, right, of music and musical creation, both in terms of, you know, sort of existential questions, but also in terms of simply keeping communities together, sane and able to survive, to put up with, you know, and be able to face the white day, basically.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think that definitely came through in the different case studies that you kind of give us, you know, from chapter to chapter, for sure. So, again, there's a lot of scope to the book, but if, you know, you can see these kind of through lines, you can see the narrative, you know, in that way. And then going to sort of the core argument of the book, you state that, quote, the thesis is that a critical account of the historical development of the Afro-diasporic musical tradition must be represented as one of resistance, accommodation, creolization, and transculturation, as reflected in these four cases of stylistic evolution, end quote. So how do these four case studies, or in other words, the four chapters that follow, do this? You were kind of talking about this a little bit, but...
Well, I mean, for the case studies I chose, I try to actually follow the, you know, kind of, it creates a historical kind of chronology, even though we're looking at different places at different times, right? So... it's not exactly a sort of, I'm not, you know, tracing the entire history of Calypso, right, you know, from the very beginning up to the Mighty Sparrow or anything like that, but it's
that
really
would be a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Right? It's really about just looking like, let's just take a little snapshot of these kind of particular moments, usually about a decade, a little more or less for each kind of chapter, and let's just sort of look at what's going on, you know, and then there's just, I mean, there's obviously like so much more, right? You know, and so many more musics that I don't even address or, you know, or just kind of talk about in passing, right? You know, but the real, for me, the real story is kind of talking about, you know, music is a sort of low intensity warfare. Music is another register of working class struggles, right? You know, labor struggles, anti-colonial struggles, anti-racist struggles, all these sorts of things, right? So taking not just the musical sound seriously, you know, not just the groove seriously, but also what the music saying something too. Right, you know, even at its most sort of anodyne or its most kind of abstract, right, it's still kind of speaking about something. And so it's like, well, you know, if we listen closely, we can, you know, we can hear a lot more than just a, you know, a nice groove. It just helps, you know, like history you can dance to. That's pretty cool. So that's kind of the idea, right? You know? And so each of the kind of case studies, right, is just, you know, different danceable moments and, you know, important moments in the larger history of the Caribbean and the Black Atlantic, but also very important moments stylistically in terms of the evolution of this music, the evolution of this kind of Atlantic world sound. So that's where that's at.
Cool. Thank you for kind of summarizing that. I think that sets the stage really well for kind of as we continue going more into the actual chapters for our listeners. So it's always good to give some context. So shifting to the actual first chapter, you know, like you talked about, you get into a specific time period of Trinidadian Calypso, stating, quote, "The history of Calypso reveals the continuous dialogues, debates, conflicts, and conversations that shaped the music as Carnival became a national festival and Calypso a national music. Race and class conflict, gender roles, poverty and hardship, and the joys and pains of Trinidadian life all found expression in and were mediated by the form," end quote. So for our listeners, can you tell them what was going on in Trinidad at this time that manifested in this music?
Well, I mean, when we're looking at not just Trinidad, but the Caribbean in general at this kind of period, the interwar period is a particular kind of fertile moment for a lot of labor struggles, but also a lot of kind of political movements and political organizations, right? You know, so this is the same moment when, say, someone like Marcus Garvey is, you know, creating this massive international organization, the United Negro Improvement Association, right? With all these Caribbean peoples, both, you know, he's headquartered in New York, of course, but, you know, there's all these chapters of the UNI, you know, throughout the United States, but also throughout the Caribbean and even on the African kind of continent, right? So Calypso is right in the midst of all this stuff. Another thing that's happening that's very important in Trinidad in particular is the discovery of these huge oil fields, right? You know, and so all of this is also happening at the same time that the United States is kind of coming in, building bases, but also, you know, United States workers, private companies are coming in and, you know, making mint off of these new oil fields. And right now, the oil fields are going to lead to like the Tin Pan and all that kind of stuff, like later on, but that I don't get into. But so the sort of overlapping of the kind of labor struggles and anti-colonial struggles in the Caribbean in general, right, you know, but also on the African continent and, you know, throughout the so-called third world, this particular time period, really find this kind of airing in the Calypso. I mean, like one of the most famous ones, right, you know, the Lord Invader's rum and Coca-Cola, right, you know. And chorus, right, working for the Yankee dollar. You know, he's talking about the way in which, right, the new imperialism is no longer the British that are the problem, right? You know, it's these, you know, it's the giant with the seven league boots up north, and that's becoming, you know, like the real kind of key player in the Caribbean Sea that they're now talking about is the American Mediterranean. And so the Calypso is kind of talking about all this is going on. We're trying to get free from the British, but at the same time, you know, we're trying, you know, we're being rapidly pulled into this American orbit, this US orbit, right? You know, and so it really is about labor and it's about anti-colonialism, but also it's about everyday life, right? So the gender politics of Trinidad, you know, like all of this, you find this kind of important expression in these calypsos, often quite fucked up. I mean, often quite, you know, not PC, but, you know, it is airing, you know, like, you know, very much what's happening, right? You know, as I forget who was it who said, you know, the calypso, it's the poor man's newspaper, right? You know, this is how, like, a lot of events got covered, but it's also a way of just sort of talking about, like, everyday life in this crazy world that was Trinidad at that moment. I don't know if I answered your question or if I just kind of...
No, I think it did. I appreciated how you kind of, again, spoke to kind of the larger, you know, issues that were going on in the Caribbean at large with that as well. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that you're using this music, you know, as a historical source to, you know, especially when you compared it, like that quote to the newspaper, I thought that was an interesting, it's all like music is sort of a text in that way, or music is sort of a primary source.
Absolutely. I mean, that is my primary source, right? It is music and recording. And it's a great book. I think it's a John Shepherd, right? Music is social text, you know, and like, that's kind of like what I'm trying to think about. What can the music tell us? You know, of course we can dance to it, but you know, it's all, there's also politics and history at a different register.
Yeah. And, you know, as you were working on this book, what were some of the like pros and cons maybe of using those kind of sources for a historical text? Like, you know, what makes music a different type of primary source than, say, an actual newspaper, obviously?
Well, I mean, like when I was doing it, I was actually going through actual newspapers, like in archives in Trinidad and going to Cuba and places like that and such, right? You know, and all incredibly informative, right? You know, but that's only for, or at least for me, that's only for setting the scene, right? You know, that's only for like let's try to kind of historically, you know, for me conceptually, like kind of recreate the space in which this sonic events are kind of happening, right? You know, like what are the musicians talking about on the day to day when they're not on the bandstand? You know, like are they getting to and from work kind of stuff? So using that kind of stuff is important for, you know, laying the foundation for the history I'm trying to tell with the music. But at the end of the day, right, you know, I'm like, you know, just listen to the music. Right? You know, rather than having a book, I'd rather just have like a hot, like, you know, kind of greatest hit CD, you know, sell that instead of, you know, a bunch of words about it. You know, the famous quote, right? You know, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. But at the same time, right, dancing is about architecture, right? You know, it's about bodies and space and motion and time and how we orient, right? You know, but at the same time, right, you know, how do you really, like, write about music? Right? Shut up and listen.
Yes. It is an interesting challenge, for sure. No, it was interesting to hear. And then going on to chapter 2, you know, we go on to the Cuban music case study, you conclude that, quote, the music of Cuba reveals the layers of the transculturative matrix of the Circum-Caribbean and historical development of African peoples in the New World. The transformation of ethnicity into race is demonstrated in the development of clave consciousness, both musically and philosophically, and the distinctively Cuban approach to musicking. Can you talk more about that?
Well, I mean, clave, like, I mean, you know, just as a basic sort of simple, like, kind of 2-3 rhythm, or 3-2, depending upon which way you play it and start it, to me, really encapsulates, right? It's because it's kind of a sort of compromise between sort of African and European aesthetic approaches, right? You know, so you get that kind of triplet feel within a sort of 4-meter or 4-beat kind of measure, right? So the clave symbolically and, you know, sonically, right, represents this kind of coming together of the so-called New World, right? You know, that only comes together from this history of slavery, from this history of, you know, European colonialism, genocide, all, you know, all that fun stuff. But the clave, like, you know, musically and symbolically, right, really kind of embodies that. And depending upon which way you start on the 3 or on the 2, right? But I mean, for me, like, the whole idea, like, really comes from, you know, like, the great historian, Cuban historian Fernando Ortiz, right, in his book Cuban Counterpoint, which conceptually brings that all together. And for him, it's, you know, coffee and sugar, right? You know, for me, it's, you know, 3 and 2. But the same idea, right? You know, it's so indebted to his work and Marinho Frainales, right? You know, his work on the sugar plantations, right? You know, and these kinds of things. And that's really what makes that Cuban groove so infectious, is that, you know, that nice driving, repetitive rhythm, but you never really kind of get lost just because it kind of keeps on going. I mean, it's crazy. Those Cuban percussionists get and everything else is going on because they're just like nutty, nutty music makers. But that clave, like it anchors the whole thing. And arguably it anchors almost all of the music of the Caribbean, right? You know, you can count clave to pretty much anything on any of those islands, right? Even when it's not being played, right? It's being played, you know? So that's what I was trying to get at. Like, how do we think about, you know, it's this fundamental question, like what holds all this Black music together, right? The Trinidadians are not Cubans, the Cubans aren't Puerto Ricans, the Puerto Ricans, you know, aren't, you know, from Mobile, Alabama, right? You know, but there is a sonic kind of unity. So clave becomes, a way of kind of thinking through that, you know, both metaphorically, but also quite literally, like in terms of thinking about how those rhythms are coming together, right? You know, and if you can't keep clave, right, you know, you're not playing, you know, you get it all cruzado, right? You know, you're crossing things and, you know, and then everybody starts laughing at you, you know? So it's not only a conceptual anchor, but it's also like, you know, if you can't do that, you really can't sit in the jam session. So, you know, it's about, it's, you know, back to that idea, you know, it feels good to know how to feel good. And if you can't, you can't keep time.
Also, it sounds like you've had personal experience with this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I've been laughed at. you know, like my bongo playing is not fantastic, but, you know, I should never give up. You know? I mean, because it is like really for these like kind of larger ensembles, right? You know, like if you're like over here and everyone else is over there, right? You know, it really stands out. It's a little embarrassing for everybody, right? So if you can't dance, you shouldn't be in the middle of the dance floor. It's that kind of thing. But the whole thing about it is, right, you know, back to the kind of clave consciousness, is the idea that it's actually kind of imprinted in people, right? You know, it's not about, like, you don't have to actually, now I'm playing clave, right? You know, you just start grooving, right? And that's what you get. Like, you know, like, I mean, seriously, like, I'm like walking around Cuba, like, and you see like little kids just, you know, just beating it out, you know, and it's just like from that early age, right? You know, that's just how time works. And that's a very important and very awesome kind of thing. Right? That's where you begin. Right? That's how you start to, you know, sort of, that's your temporal measurement. You know, you got a potentially exciting life ahead of you. Right? Far more exciting than 4-4, you know.
Common time. Nope. That's really cool. I mean, really interesting to kind of hear how it is so much into people's consciousness in that way. Like, that's really fascinating. And then going on to the third chapter/case study entitled, quote, "The Oral Making and Unmaking of the Third World, 1955 to 1965. You wrap everything up in this chapter with this quote, "The confluence of Cold War geopolitical and domestic developments, decolonization, the invention of the Third World and civil rights military, coupled with a Black internationalist renaissance, was counterpointed and elaborated in Black cultural practices and creative expressions. This period of musical creativity made audible and visible oppositional aesthetic collectivities, articulated a critical musical vocabulary of resistance, and embodied an alternative archive of the historiography of decolonization at home and abroad in sonic iconicities and allegorical forms," end quote. So quite a punch of a conclusion there. So can you talk more about, again, going back to music as the source, what are some examples during this time of Black musical expressions that were, you know, reflecting all this?
Well, I mean, like, for me, like, how I first really started thinking about this was the music of Randy Weston, you know, and just started really getting deep into what Randy Weston was doing and still is doing, and particularly his record, Uhuru Africa. And that was also one of these things where you had this like amazing, just huge band of all these incredible, incredible musicians. But also thinking about what he was trying to say at that particular moment in the 1960s. And that led me kind of down this whole rabbit hole and back to, you know, Max Roach's album, which comes out a little bit before that, right? You know, The Freedom Now, right? You know, where he has the wonderful album cover, right, with the cats, you know, at the sit-in, you know, at the lunch counter, right, you know, and it's just this incredibly powerful music with Abby Lincoln, like, doing this incredible work, right, you know, so that just really kind of got me thinking about this music in this kind of Cold War period, which is also the period of the Civil Rights Movement, right, and the beginnings of, you know, decolonization on the continent, on the African continent, so all the music is responding to all of these things, right, you know, and kind of talking about all these things. So one of the reasons why like the Western was key is because he does bring musicians from all over the diaspora to play together on that particular thing. And it does start kind of creating this kind of notion, like it seems so quaint and antiquated now, but there was a moment when like the idea of the third world was actually like a really kind of potent and important kind of political idea for people of color across the, you know, not just the United States or the Caribbean, but around the world, right? So, you know, the Bandung Conference is something that I try to kind of center in this story, because that was a massive thing, you know, and that was widely covered in the black press in the United States. And people were really kind of talking about that as this kind of idea, right? You know, I mean, and shortly thereafter, right, we're going to see the whole sort of the war in Vietnam, first beginning with France, right, you know, and then obviously the United States. But that was also being seen as like, wow, you know, like, that's, you know, they kick the shit out of the French. So, you know, people are getting their heads in a different kind of way. And that's the whole idea of, you know, like the idea of the third world, not as a pejorative sense, but as an actual, like, really awesome sense of, like, is a new day in Babylon. Like, if we can get, you know, this kind of anti-colonial, anti-racist, you know, new political movement going, the whole non-aligned movement, we don't have to have a white person in charge, be it Russia or the United States. Let's kind of do our own thing. And the musicians were really kind of tapping into that, both in terms of what they would say about the music they were making, but also in terms of the kind of collaborations, like the musicians they were getting to play, they were trying to, you know, literally make that a reality, you know, if only in the studio, you know, but that's how we got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah. And as you were, you know, talking a little bit, it made me think about kind of what's going on, like, in the present moment. How are you seeing, you know, now musical expressions that, you know, reflect the current, like, anti-racist, you know, forms of resistance, you know, Black Lives Matter kind of stuff? What do you see going on in these regions at the moment?
I mean, in terms of, like, contemporary music, not a lot. It's actually quite depressing. I mean, for me, like, personally, like, I don't see a whole lot of, I mean, not to take away from, I mean, there's tons of, you know, fabulous, you know, fantastic, talented performers, musicians, vocalists, songwriters, all that kind of stuff. But I think, and I think it's also reflective of the larger kind of political moment where, you know, there isn't a sort of centralized civil rights movement. I mean, there's kind of Black Lives Matter, but that's, you know, kind of a looser kind of coalition, but there isn't really a sort of large movement culture, right, to really kind of tap into. And there really aren't people, you know, like, there's, you know, civil rights anthems coming out here, you know, I mean, maybe Beyonce's Formation or something like that. You know? But, you know, beyond those kind of gestures, there really isn't a movement as such to attach itself to, right? And there isn't music, you know, there's no soundtrack for what's happening right now, unless it's like, you know, The Weeknd or something, you know? Like, you know, I don't really follow like contemporary music, so I don't really know. After about 1975, my ears kind of drop off. So there's a lot of stuff I really don't know.
Fair enough. Yeah, fair enough. I was just like kind of thinking about that, like, you know, again, it's another source of the historical moment. It'll be interesting to see if there are such responses, responses rather.
I mean, I think the music's always going to have some sort of response. Will it form some sort of coherent political platform? At this point, most likely not. But there's always going to be, you know, the music is always going to be speaking to the times, right? You know, it's just, You know, right now it's just Cardi B speaking to the time. You know, which, you know, for good or ill, you know, that's just where we're at. You know? But
my God, yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, interesting. Going back in time now, so going to the last chapter, we have shifted to salsa. For this chapter, you explain that, quote, the production of salsa must be located in the historical context of New York in the 1960s and early 1970s, and we must understand that salsa as praxis and process was pan-Latino and Afro-Caribbean, but decidedly New Yorican, so end quote. And that salsa, quote, was the sound of the New Yorican youth, the voice of the people who, in the midst of New York City hardship, were still able to find and create moments of freedom that would resonate throughout the Circum-Caribbean and the African diaspora, end quote. So can you talk about this sort of place of salsa and the significance of salsa to these communities at these different intersections, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I should say first is Johnny Pacheco just passed away, and he's absolutely central to the story of this, the rise of salsa, and in particular the rise of this record company called Fania. So may he rest in peace. But what one of the things that that really got me going on this one was, and this is where I kind of stole the title from, was this album called, by a group called Grupo Folklorico. And it was kind of, the album was called Concepts in Unity, and Grupo Folklorico y Experimental, de Nuevo Yorkino. And it had this kind of who's who of like salsa players, largely spearheaded by Andy and Jerry Gonzalez, the Gonzalez brothers, but Oscar Hernandez, like all kinds of people on this, right? You know, and the thing that was cool about this when I discovered it, because I was into this, I was like, what is this Latin sound stuff? I knew my Santana and all that, but I was like, this is something different. And I went to this concert, and these cats were playing, all these like kind of jazz standards, Miles Davis tunes and Monk tunes, but they had like conga going, right? Yeah, they had that clave consciousness going. I was like, this is slamming. Then I found this Concepts in Unity record, right? And the thing that was really cool about this is not only was it a who's who, on the back they gave kind of short biographies of all the musicians, like all the different bands they played in. So that became like really my Bible. Because at that point, my Spanish was horrible. I had no idea what I was looking for. But now you just go to the record store. It's like, I know that guy. So I just start buying records. And but the thing that about that really kind of brought it together in my head is that I was starting to listen more and more to it. Was just kind of thinking about the history of New York, right? Where are these cats living, right? And then they're not in Westchester, right? So like, and who are they kind of interacting with, and how you can hear these kind of influences. So like the whole history of Lulu, right? Which is this irony, and I'm sorry, this kind of sidebar here. The Boogaloo Boys and this kind of crazy right-wing stuff. I'm just like, do they not realize what Boogaloo actually like was? Cause like, why did they want to kind of appropriate, this kind of Black and Latino, like kind of music form for their, white racial project. And it's just like, so, sorry, the side note on that one, but I just think it's kind of hilarious. But, I mean, funny, in a tragic sense, as we saw at the Capitol, but anyway, it was like this music, right? Just kind of really capturing this kind of particular moment, drawing on African-American traditions very much so, but also really speaking to this identity of these, Caribbean peoples in New York City, right? You're a long way from, from Havana, or, from San Juan, and these kind of things, right? And how they're making sense out of that sound, right? Stuck in these ghettos next to these Black people, from the Deep South, from Alabama, and, from Louisiana, right? And from these kind of different places, and how these people are all making sense out of this new reality and the cold, making sense out of like what it's like up that way, right? And so this salsa stuff, right? Much like hip hop, kind of coming out of the same neighborhood, just about 20 years later, right? Is really speaking to that new identity, that new reality of those people, right? And obviously, Fania Records in particular was absolutely central to not only recording music, but kind of creating that sense of identity and community.
But thank you for joining us today on New Books and Music. I wanted to ask you, what projects are you working on these days?
Like I might have mentioned, I'm trying to get back to Africa. Like I'm, you know, the Caribbean. Like my undergraduate stuff started in mainly the American South and African American musics, and then you know did this like kind of little Caribbean thing, and eventually I'm gonna you know actually get my way back to the continent because I really want to do some stuff on like high life in particular, and looking at African music in the 50s and 60s and the rise of the recording industry there, you know, starting in the 30s and moving on. But I'm actually currently working on a book on like Hegel and Karl Marx, so a little bit different.
Sounds like all kinds of fun and exciting stuff coming up.
Dead white guys.
Oh, yeah. The never-ending trail of them.
Oh, no. Okay.
But I will look forward to reading more of your work in the future. Appreciate it. And listeners, we have to thank you as well. We couldn't do this without you. Just as a recap, this is the end of an interview with Dr. Jorge Jorge, author of Chocolate Surrealism, Music, Movement, Memory, and History in the Circum-Caribbean, published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2016. This is Emily Allen, and please join me next time here on New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network.